Deep dive into the world of science with Nature Plus. From the vastness of the distant star systems to the intricacies of infectious diseases due to climate change, we've got you covered. Enjoy access to over 55 cutting-edge journals, breaking scientific news, and over 1,000 new articles every month. Whether you're a seasoned researcher or just curious, Nature Plus simplifies complex studies. Plus, it's all available right at your fingertips on nature.com. Nature Plus, the key to unlocking the world's most significant scientific advances. Subscribe today at go.nature.com/plus.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello and welcome to Backchat. If the Nature podcast is a direct and firm order from someone in a position of authority, then Backchat is a sly wink and a nudge in the ribs. And appropriately, this month Backchat is all about manipulation. Manipulating ourselves with drugs or with our own thoughts, or manipulating others, or others manipulating us. All topics that we've covered in some way or another in Nature during February. I'm Kerry Smith and I'm pleased to introduce my manipulative colleagues, David Adam.
Hello, I work for Nature. I commission and edit the editorials and the Worldview opinion page.
Also joining us, Sara Abdullah.
Hello, Kerry. I'm Sara. I run the comment section.
And on the phone from Munich, Alison Abbott.
Hi, Kerry. Yes, I'm a journalist with Nature. And as you said, I work out of the Munich office.
Lovely. Now, coming up, psychologists rerun one of the most infamous experiments in history, Stanley Milgram's study showing how people blindly obey authority. And how should we game our own natures, manipulate our own cognitive biases so that they work in our favour, particularly for the benefit of future humans? And we'll also be discussing the best way to manipulate brains so they perform better. Let's begin with an update to a famous, infamous experiment. Alison Abbott, you've been writing about this in a news story. Can you just tell us a little bit about Stanley Milgram and the original study he performed in the 60s?
Well, it's actually a series of studies that he performed in the 60s and the beginning of the 1970s. And it's essentially to investigate to what extent will we obey orders to harm other people. What Milgram did was to recruit people who thought that they were taking part in an experiment on learning. And he told them that what they had to do was to control a person learning in a neighbouring room, that they could hear him but they could not see him. When that person made a mistake, they would press a button to deliver an electric shock to them. And each time they made a mistake, the electric shock given would be stronger. They could hear the screams of this person, who in fact was an actor and not receiving any pain at all. And at a certain point, around about a fictitious 150 volts, the person actually went silent, indicating that he'd gone unconscious or died, but the people still kept pressing the button. And what we learn from this is that if you do receive orders to hurt somebody, you will actually carry them out.
And it was controversial, wasn't it, because of the links Milgram made to, well, this is perhaps how we can explain how Nazis behaved and followed orders, inverted commas, blindly. But it was also controversial for the ethical situation he put people in, right? The actual participants.
Yes, I think it was interesting because of its relevance to the situation in wars like in the Third Reich. The unethical part of his experiment, the controversial part of his experiment, was in deceiving people into thinking that they really had caused extreme harm to somebody else, perhaps even killed them. This is why, since then, nobody has ever been able to repeat those experiments, even though they're very important, because you would never get ethical permission, and quite rightly so too.
So Patrick Haggard, the psychologist and neuroscientist at UCL, has in fact gained permission recently to do something similar, if not quite the same. Tell us about this modern Milgram experiment.
The thoroughly modern Milgram, as our editor said about it. So in this, there was no deception involved. And counterintuitively, the participants in the study actually did inflict pain.
Right, so Haggard and his team had participants sit opposite each other in pairs, and they had a few options. They could either choose to take a small amount of money from the other person, choose to take money and give the person a painful electric shock, or they could be ordered by the experimenter just to take the money, or take the money and give them the shock.
While they were doing this, they were measuring two things. Firstly, a sort of a time perception measure, because psychologists know that the perceived time interval between your action and the outcome of your action seems shorter if you think you're in charge of it. And it seems longer if you're essentially feeling that you're doing something passively or somebody else is responsible. And secondly, in a different experiment, they actually measured the neuronal activity in the brain in the person delivering the shock. And the fact was that there was less neuronal activity in the frontal part of the brain where complex action takes place when the people were told by the experimenter to press the button.
Is this basically just an effective replication that is appropriate for modern times, or does it move the story on?
It moves the story on, and it moves the story on in this way. Milgram's experiment showed that people will obey orders to harm others. Haggard's experiment shows how they can come to do this, what happens in their brain that makes this possible. When you are told to do something, your brain goes into a passive mode. It processes in a passive way.
Alison, how much did they interrogate this by the type of person who was asked to do this? I mean, for example, did they find that older people perhaps were less willing to do it than younger people? Or did they look at personality types and find that there was a certain personality type that was more willing to resist?
Everybody was more or less of the same age because the volunteers were students in the study. But they did do personality tests for all of them in advance of the actual experiment. And there was no impact of personality on their willingness to do this.
Are you suggesting that the brain studies suggest that this was more of an unconscious action to follow the order? They weren't actually putting any cognitive effort into processing it themselves?
I suppose that doesn't diminish, in the legal sense, responsibility for one's actions. Just because you didn't feel responsible doesn't mean you are not responsible. Or, I mean, what would legal experts say about this?
Of course, nobody thinks that just because you don't feel responsible in your unconscious way, that this in any way mitigates any crime or bad behaviour. But the debate in legal circles is really to think about, you know, where the balance of personal responsibility lies when you have this chain of command, which ends up in somebody being harmed. And I think what they would say from this experiment is that for each particular case, you would think more carefully about the personal responsibility of the person who gave the orders. In terms of military, of course, this is already part of the system. The person giving the orders carries full responsibility. But this experiment doesn't relate only to crimes and legal activities and military activities. We can think of lots of things in normal life. For example, when somebody in a government ministry misbehaves, does something that's not quite legal and this has repercussions, should the minister resign? In German governments, yes, they do. In other governments, well, they don't always take that responsibility. And this type of experiment is grist to the mill of these types of discussion.
I think what's really nice is it's a kind of these are individual examples of things that when they operate over the collective across society, it's what gives rise to norms and fads and fashions. And it's really lovely seeing it kind of broken right down to individual action.
Yeah, and that links in very nicely to our second topic, which has to do with how these individual actions and biases play out at the level of society. Sara Abdullah, you've put together a special issue which has this as one of its themes. And there's an article on how we could better manipulate ourselves and overcome our cognitive biases. That's by the behavioural economist Ernst Fehr.
He talks a lot about people are much more likely to be more frugal with their energy consumption if they hear about the energy consumption of their neighbours, or people take much better financial decisions if they have some, if in some way you can make visible the impact of their decisions. So a kind of a classic study is people are much more likely to invest in a pension if you show them what they look like, what they might look like when they're elderly. So you show them a sort of an aged photograph of themselves. People are much more likely to
that's a bit creepy.
to invest for the future. And it's kind of unsettling, but also edifying to hear about basically how poor we are at making decisions, because we all feel that we're purely sort of logical agents.
So there's a cognitive bias here, which people refer to as future discounting, where we're just not as good at thinking about the far future as we are about what's going to happen next week, next month, which is classically why people don't save enough money for their pensions. And I love this example of looking at a picture of your old self would force you to sort of put a few more pence in the pot. And this is just one example, isn't it, of how we have a really wobbly grasp of the future and how we can improve how we think about the future. What inspired you, Sara, to put the special together in the first place?
The genesis for the special issue was some of the thinking that is beginning to emerge around gene editing. So obviously that's one very white hot technology where people are beginning to think, well, actually we could take we could be taking decisions now that affect not just children, but their children and many generations hence. And do we have the ethical and philosophical frameworks to be taking those decisions? Because somebody who's born 300 years hence, what are their rights? Having brought together the package, one of the things that really struck me was that it's almost as if the generations as yet unborn are sort of the newest minority who's, they're obviously they're the majority, so it doesn't quite work apart from linguistically, but in the sense of we are doing discrimination by date of birth. So a lot of the climate models essentially devalue lives in the future as compared with lives now. But it's not something that we explicitly think about. So going back to what Alison talked about, a lot of this behaviour is implicit and subliminal. But it seems to be it's becoming baked into the maths of our models, which is alarming.
On that last point, I think empirically it's been pretty fair. It's been a pretty fair assumption that future generations will be better prepared to sort stuff out than we are, because that's what we've seen over the last few hundred years. I think it's only really in economic and social terms that we're starting to see that process in developed countries stall. And, you know, there's a big talk about how this generation or the millennial generation is going to be the first generation that actually has less in a material sense than the parents. And so I think it's right that we're now starting to challenge that, but I don't think it's necessarily a fault that that's been the assumption. I think when we talk about long-term issues, I mean, they don't come much longer term than nuclear waste, because this is stuff that we are producing now and have produced over the last 50 or 60 years, which is going to remain really dangerous for maybe a million years. A million years. What do we do with it? So one of the ideas is, are we going to stick it in the ground? And then the question becomes, well, these future generations, when they come along, because they're going to be cleverer and brighter than us, we should give them the chance to basically do what they want with it. So if we put it in a hole in the ground, we have to make sure that we don't seal that hole in the ground. We have to make sure they can go in and get it. But the problem with that is that at some point in the future, we have to assume that people are going to forget about it. Because if you think people say we don't even know how the pyramids were built or Stonehenge, or we don't know the mysteries of the Inca Empire. And these are all empires which were only a couple of thousand years ago. You know, in 500,000 years' time, we have to assume that we don't have this knowledge anymore. And therefore, even if these future generations have this amazing technology, it's irrelevant because they don't know the stuff is down there. So the worldview piece is a bit like saying, at least with nuclear waste, let's divide them into the near future generations and the far future generations. And the division between those is at the point at which the memory or the information is lost.
I can see a lot of sense in this argument, but these numbers that you're giving me, I can also feel my own cognitive bias against it, right? 500,000 years, 1 million years. I can't even think, you know, past lunchtime.
Really,
how do philosophers do this?
Well, there's no reason for you to do that, right? I mean, I don't really care. I'd much rather care about my own family and my own generations and because that's, it's a cognitive bias, but it's an entirely justifiable one because, you know, we have developed as a species not needing to care about what's going to happen in, let alone 10 years.
But this is also a political issue, isn't it? Because I think with nuclear waste, we could relatively easily solve the problem in the next 10, 20 years if we put our minds to it. But it's just sort of not possible politically to address it.
I think people, because the future generations don't have a voice, people can project a voice onto them to speak whatever they want. So if you're the kind of person who doesn't want to find a solution to nuclear waste because that's a way you think of opening the door to more nuclear power in the present, then you are going to say, well, you know, we shouldn't do this because the future generations might not want to do that. Or if you're the other way around, you might say, well, future generations are going to want to be able to do this, so therefore we should do that now, and so on and so on. So I think you're right. I think it's a people sort of invoke what they want from the future.
Have you guys got better during the course of putting this special together, thinking more about the future than normal? Do you feel yourselves with any more cognitive tools for thinking about the future than you did beforehand? Has anyone, I don't know, put things in a nice light for you that made you think, oh, yeah?
I think the discrimination by date of birth was quite a kind of moment of pause for me. That was the point at which I realised that, albeit a heterogeneous group of people and not just a kind of a mass that are all very similar, as David just said, there is a sector of society, as yet unborn, that we are... we're chucking them some fairly tricky stuff they're going to be left to deal with. I suppose, and the other thing that struck me is how there's a lot of reinventing the wheel in science. So if you work in nuclear waste, you know, even if you were working in nuclear waste in the 1960s, you've been thinking about the long now that was baked into what you did as a nuclear waste engineer or policymaker or whatever. And I think what we're trying to achieve with the package is to say, guys, walk across the corridor and talk to some of your mates who might be in a seemingly completely different field. I mean, what would nuclear waste people and genome editing people have to say to one another 5 years ago? And at least try to share some of the tools.
One of the dangers, actually, of exploring this is because the timescale is so big. It almost becomes a theoretical exercise. And I think it's easier for people to discuss the problems of the future than it is to address the problems of the present. And I feel this quite strongly about climate change. You know, a lot of people who warn about the future, I mean, it's quite the near future, you know, 100, 200 years. Oh, it's going to be awful for all of the people in the regions where the rain's going to change. But it's already really difficult for loads of people in those parts of the world now. And it's almost as if by talking about what we can do to protect the people of the future, it almost gives us sort of a moral get-out-of-jail-free card because we don't have to talk about the problems of the people of the present.
Yeah, it's almost like a Goldilocks zone. Too far away is sci-fi, too near is firefighting, and too much like a sort of emergency. But if in that mid-range, perhaps they're far enough away that we could try and solve those problems in a rational way without panicking. We've talked about then manipulating the communities we live in, manipulating our own natures. Right back to the beginning, we talked about how Milgram showed how we manipulate each other. David, you've been researching some traditional, some less traditional ways of, you know, individual manipulation, manipulating even our brains.
Well, I think in terms of the future, there is this idea that humanity is constantly improving, and they even call it sort of transhumanism or H+, if you Google it. One of the things that I'm very interested in on a personal level is mental illness and treatments around mental illness. One of the things that I know they're looking at is they've gone right back to 100 years ago, and they're starting to see whether they can use small electric currents and magnetic fields to change the way the brain works in mental illness. Now, the exact mechanism is a bit of a mystery. It's a little bit like we've done some brain scans. We know that this region of the brain seems to work differently in schizophrenia or depression or OCD. So we're going to try and change the way it functions by blasting it, or not blasting it, by tickling it with electricity or magnets. So that's being done, and it's being done in a very controlled clinical way. But because it's so easy to do it, people are also doing it on themselves.
Terms and conditions apply.
Absolutely, yeah. And so I'm very interested in that, both that as a dynamic and also just the question of, well, does it work? And if it does work, the ethical questions are extraordinary.
I mean, the other thing that's become sort of semi-ubiquitous in some circles is drugs for cognitive enhancement. So originally they were produced for kind of Alzheimer's treatments. And then, you know, if one worked out, you could kind of ace your finals. You get into a kind of, well, if I'm at some extremely swanky university and I'm not taking these things to do my finals, I'm going to be at a disadvantage. And then the norms shift. In the UK, there's been some public consultation exercises around enhancement in general, genetic, cognitive, drugs, blah, 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 blah. And interestingly, what seems to emerge in terms of people's yuck factor is that people are quite comfortable with the notion of enhancement in order to aid a disability. And that runs across from kind of plastic surgery to drugs. And then once you get into enhancement to almost sort of give you superpowers, that's when the sort of the layperson's yuck factor kicks in. I mean, obviously, there's probably different responses among nerds who might think, oh, bring it, that's quite exciting. But that's kind of intriguing that across all different technologies, we have a sense of ease with therapeutic enhancement, but a sense of there's something a bit uncanny and distressing about, the creation of a kind of Gattaca-style super race.
Just because we've got back to ethics at the very end here, Alison, I'm just intrigued to ask you a question I forgot to ask you earlier. Firstly, did Patrick Haggard take ages to get ethical approval? And then secondly, are there any other tests you or psychologists would love to see rerun now that we've been able to do Milgram again?
I don't think Patrick had a lot of trouble getting ethical permission because he designed the experiment to be not unethical. So no problem there, I think.
The one that everybody sort of brackets often with Milgram is the Stanford Prison Experiment.
Philip Zimbardo.
Has that been rerun? Should it be?
I think that was an extremely unethical experiment that doesn't need to be rerun. And in a sense, one has to say, what do we want to gain by rerunning the experiment? And in many ways, Patrick Haggard did not rerun the Milgram experiment. He ran an experiment which was asking scientific questions that emerged really from the Milgram experiment. So it's a sort of next generation Milgram. So probably none of this needs to be redone in a way.
There's been other ways of other reruns. I think I wrote a story in like almost 10 years ago for Nature about a virtual reality rerun of Milgram where you were harming a virtual reality character, and even then the same effects kind of came to the fore. But even though people were looking at a computer and knowing that it was a computer, still some of the psychological effects that he had observed were there. Can I thank you all at the very end of the show here for joining me? And just FYI, there will be no need to further enhance your amazing brains. They are great as they are. Thank you to Alison Abbott, to Sara Abdullah, and to David Adam for joining me. I'm Kerry Smith. This has been Backchat. Thanks for listening.
Deep dive into the world of science with Nature Plus. From the vastness of the distant star systems to the intricacies of infectious diseases due to climate change, we've got you covered. Enjoy access to over 55 cutting-edge journals, breaking scientific news, and over 1,000 new articles every month. Whether you're a seasoned researcher or just curious, Nature Plus simplifies complex studies. Plus, it's all available right at your fingertips on nature.com. Nature Plus. The key to unlocking the world's most significant scientific advances. Subscribe today at go.nature.com/plus.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.